It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Lawmakers and school administrators have very different ideas about what to do with Wisconsin's next education budget. Coming up, we'll find out what those differences are and ask you to weigh in with your education wish list.
First, last Thursday, President Obama addressed the nation in prime time to announce that he's taking executive action to address illegal immigration in the country. His executive order included increasing border security, making it easier for high-skilled workers to stay in the United States, and blocking the deportation of about 4 million immigrants. The last part of the order has been by far the most controversial.
The president said he was taking action on his own because of Congress's failure to pass a bill. Republicans say he's acting outside of his authority as president. They plan to try to stop the action, maybe with lawsuits, maybe by blocking funding if possible.
We got a reaction from Wisconsin's Democratic U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin on Friday. She was supportive of the president's action.
Republican U.S. Senator Ron Johnson joins us now. Senator Johnson, welcome back to the show.
Hello, Rob. Hello, Veronica. How are you guys doing?
Well, real good. Now, what's your initial response? What was your initial response to the president's executive action on immigration on Thursday?
Well, it's unfortunate that he's acting unilaterally. You know, as you pointed out, the first two measures that he proposed, there's, I think, broad agreement on. Putting additional resources at the border, speeding return of illegal immigrants, focusing on criminals and high-skilled workers. There's a great deal of agreement on that. And, I've done a lot of negotiating in my business career, built a lot of relationships. The way I'd always approach negotiations, I'd spend a lot of time figuring out everything we agreed on first, build a relationship, build a level of trust, and it was a whole lot easier than finding common ground on the areas of disagreement. President Obama, unfortunately, has chosen to start out a relationship with the new Congress by picking a fight, and it's not conducive. It's going to make it more difficult to find the common ground and actually solve this problem, because there's a lot of us that really would. And oh, by the way, he really does not have the constitutional or legal authority to do what he did.
And we've heard from some legal scholars since last Thursday saying probably this is legal. The president has prosecutorial discretion powers. The administration does. So it on a legal ground, it probably would stand up to challenges. You don't buy that?
No, I don't, because prosecutorial discretion is really on a case-by-case basis. And even I've been starting to read some of the analysis of his own legal counsel talks about it has to be on a case-by-case basis. It can't be based on broad criteria. And he's granting discretion based on broad criteria. And again, even put aside the legality of it, the fact is there are plenty of us, I'm one of them, that want to solve this immigration problem. But first and foremost, I think we have to secure our border and we have to enforce our current laws. There ought to be plenty of areas where we can agree on things. Let's do those things first. This is a really bad way to start out the new Congress.
His argument is he's been president 6 years, hasn't seen the bills coming from Congress, so we've got this situation that needs to be dealt with. He's not expecting much better, I guess, from an all-Republican Congress, so he needed to do something.
No, he's just wrong. As a candidate, Candidate Obama said about immigration, he said that I can guarantee immigration is that we'll have in the first year an immigration bill that I strongly support and that I'm promoting. Now, in the first 2 years, President Obama had a filibuster-proof Senate. He totally controlled Washington. He could have passed an immigration solution that he liked. He didn't do that. So I think what that should show people is that President Obama really isn't interested in solving the problem. He wants a political issue. He's using immigration as a political weapon. He's playing with people's lives, and I think it's very unfortunate. I think it's very cynical of him. And again, he could have fixed this problem the first 2 years. He chose not to do so. He should give the new Congress a chance to fix it. But now he's acting unilaterally, and again, I really do not think he's got the constitutional legal authority to do what he's doing.
Is this move really all that dramatic? There are millions of people here undocumented. We don't have the resources to prosecute and deport all of them. The reality is most of the people, probably unless they fell afoul of the police in some way or another, weren't going to be deported. Is this really that big a departure?
It is, because his deferred action on childhood admissions is the basic cause for the flooding of the borders of all these kids out of Central America. So when you create incentives, when you defer action, you send a signal to other immigrants that are willing to come in here illegally. Let's face it, you know, I know he's set up criteria. You've got to be here 5 years. There's going to be a cottage industry set up on forged documents. He says you've got to pay your fair share of taxes. How do you enforce that? So the fact of the matter is, when you deferred action on childhood admissions, it caused a flood. It increased the incentive for illegal immigration, and we got more of it. So his deferred action, even though he says it's not going to apply to new people coming into this country, it will, because you won't be able to control it. So it'll increase the incentive. There will be more illegal immigration, which means we have to double and triple our efforts to finally secure the border.
As part of a Senate Republican majority and head of a very relevant committee in the next session, what kind of laws, looking forward, do you want to try to pass, get together with the House on, and send to the president?
Well, my first priority actually is a border security and enforcement bill, and I will look for common ground, but President Obama just made it more difficult to do that. But I'm going to still focus all my attention to that. On the governmental affairs portion of the committee, that's really having to do with, you know, evaluating governmental regulations, and I think there will be plenty of areas where we can find some common ground on regulations that affect businesses, even in Democrat senator states. And so I really think we've got some pretty good opportunities. I'd love to see a broader type of regulatory reform, something like the RAINS Act, which allows Congress to disapprove of any regulation that has a compliance cost of more than $100 million. But if we can't pass a broader reform, I'm happy to look at individual regulations, more of a rifle shot approach to that. Do whatever we can to really reduce the regulatory burden on the American economy, to try and get a more robust economic growth. That's really how you build a strong middle class, by having good paying jobs.
Well, on immigration, you're saying border security, and I think Democrat supporters of reform are saying, you know, Republicans want to pass border security and that's it. After that, is there a next step for dealing with the issue of the people here already?
Yeah, absolutely. And quite honestly, what I've been talking about, because I think it's true, now, I'm going to look at any problem as a root cause analysis. And if you really want to secure the border, what you should do is be focusing on eliminating the incentives for illegal immigration. President Obama just increased those incentives. But if you really take a look, why do most people come here illegally? It really is to work. And so what you should do is you should have a functioning guest worker program. So you make as much of that immigration legal. If you do that, you dramatically reduce the number of people coming here illegally, and it's a whole lot easier securing the border. So, no, I'm absolutely for a guest worker program. I'm happy to deal with the people that are here that are working in the shadows. We need to take care of that, but you have to secure the border first. Otherwise, you're creating those incentives, and you just exacerbate the problem. You make it worse, and that's what President Obama's action is going to do. He's going to make the problem worse.
Sometimes when people talk guest worker programs, they're talking high-skill jobs, high-tech jobs. Are you also thinking of things like, you know, farm workers?
Absolutely. You know, we've got a lot of migrant workers here working dairy, and from my standpoint, what I'd like to do is I'd like to see states set the quotas. I'd like to see states set the prevailing wages in different industries in their states. You know, I'm opposed to minimum wage laws for the general economy, but I'm not opposed to set prevailing wages for immigration, because you certainly don't want to incentivize employers to depress American wages. So I'm happy to allow the states to set that for their own particular industries and set their own quotas.
So looking ahead again, Republicans in the House and the Senate, a lot of your colleagues have talked about a wide variety of responses in the next year, including trying to cut funding for relevant programs. I mentioned lawsuits earlier. Where do you fall? What do you want to see to try to stop what the president's doing, if anything?
Well, as you're aware, I've had my own lawsuit about President Obama's unlawful regulation regarding special treatment for members of Congress and their staff under Obamacare. So I think that's a legitimate way of challenging this this unconstitutional activity by the president. The other thing we can do now that we have control or majority in the Senate, we can also hopefully pass all 12 appropriation bills. And in each one of those appropriation bills, the actions that President Obama is taking that we don't believe is constitutional, we've got the power of the purse. We can simply defund those specific areas. Again, it's not threatening any kind of shutdowns. It would be very targeted, very focused. But I think that also be an appropriate response on the part of Republican Congress.
All right, Senator Johnson, thanks for joining us again.
Have a great day. And by the way, have a happy Thanksgiving.
And you too. We've been speaking with U.S. Senator Ron Johnson about the president's executive action late last week on immigration. Tony Evers, head of the Department of Public Instruction here in the state, is officially asking the legislature to increase funding for K-12 schools by over $600 million in the next two-year budget.
In addition, he'd like to increase the amount of money schools can raise in local taxes and find a new way to fund the Milwaukee School Voucher Program.
Since then, school administrators around the state have shared their outline, their wish list for education funding, but state lawmakers have announced other priorities, including a new school accountability system.
We'd like to hear from you on these issues. Are you the parent of a public school student? How do you think your school district is doing financially? What's on your wish list for education priorities? You can let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at talk@WPR.org.
Erin Richards joins us now. She's an education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Erin, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Well, let's lay out some of the newest budget-related news, if we can, in addition to what we heard from Superintendent Evers. The Association of Wisconsin School Administrators put their policy agenda. Some people have called it a wish list. What kind of things are they asking for in the state budget?
A lot of the things that the school administrators want to see, I would call, are things that a lot of public school folks have been asking for a long time. And of course, that also means more money for things that people feel are important. So for example, more funding for low-income students, students who are learning a second language, and students with special needs. A lot of that funding has been frozen, or at least it hasn't been significantly increased. And yet, you know, as we know, the bilingual population in Wisconsin is growing, and schools are tasked with teaching a lot of these kids with the same resources they've had for the last several years. You're also seeing them campaign for things like a greater investment in early childhood education, more kindergarten, more robust services for kids who are, in sort of before they start kindergarten. Things like school-based mental health services, the things that have been tried around the state and are showing some improvement in, helping kids feel better and more stable in their schooling careers. And then overall, I think the big ticket items are a more sustainable school finance system, you know, a way for school administrators to be able to plan for more than just 2 years for every state budget cycle, and to index things like the there's this limit that caps how much school districts can raise in local property taxes and state aid. And the administrators would like to see that be tied to the rate of inflation. So they'd be able to raise enough each year up to the level of the rate of inflation each year instead of being capped by, sort of the outlines of the state budget.
So when we're talking about things like funding mental health programs in schools, early child education, and bilingual education, are these things we're hearing from a lot of districts in the state that, hey, these are hurdles that we're having to face, and they're costly hurdles?
The School Administrators Alliance represents superintendents, school leaders, school business officials. So it's the blanket lobbying group for these people that hold the higher level administrative positions in public schools. And yes, I think you can even call around the state and talk to schools and say, what are your challenges? Certainly those are going to be different if you talk to schools in rural areas, which struggle with things like enough money for transportation services, keeping quality teachers in more rural areas. Oftentimes when people are good or want to climb the ladder, they'd like to work in a bigger district in a more populated area because salaries tend to be higher. So those are certainly struggles as well that aren't exactly addressed by the budget requests. But I do think that this is a pretty comprehensive ask for stuff that people that are involved in schools and talk to a lot of people in districts tend to ask for pretty regularly. Hey, we need more special ed services. We'd like to be able to budget farther into the future than just 2 years. So how about taking a look at the school finance system?
Now, also in the request, something about funding statewide teacher and principal evaluation systems. What's going on there? What are they looking for into the future?
The state has already implemented a teacher and principal evaluation system. This is a statewide system. It's meant to bring some uniformity to the way that we look at the performance of teachers. In the past, it's been really haphazard. It can be pretty random, especially if you're a veteran teacher. A lot of people just didn't even get reviewed. So the state, a group got together, a pretty comprehensive state group, said, we can do this better. It was also tied to the state's waiver from some the No Child Left Behind Act. So they had to put in place a state evaluation system. The issue is the state gave them money in the last budget to pay for things like the training that all your principals have to go through if you're going to standardize a system of evaluations. What the administrators would like to see is that funding continue. So continue to help us implement this system. You've got to start it with 2 years of training and, you know, sort of readiness to launch this evaluation for everybody. But we need some money to continue it going forward because there isn't any as of yet unless we ask for it.
Mm-hmm. And turning to the people they're asking for at the state legislature, they've been talking a lot about their various priorities, and education has been getting a lot of attention. But what kind of things have we been hearing from lawmakers when it comes to what they want to do with education early in the next session?
Well, remember after the November 4th elections, the you know, the Republicans had some pretty key wins, and a lot of the key leaders of the GOP are committed to an agenda that you know, has definitely stated that they'd like to offer tax breaks in the state, and at the same time, they would like to expand some programs that actually send public money to private schools under the idea and philosophy that kids can achieve better education outcomes if they're allowed to take public funding to the school of their choice. So again, this gets into a bit of a philosophical divide about how we think kids learn best. But what the lawmakers would also like to see that are in charge of the GOP is taking another look at the school accountability and report card system we have that we've had in place for several years now. It gives every public school in the state a report card about how they're doing on things like growth measures, achievement on the state tests, attendance, that sort of thing. And the key GOP leaders are saying, well, you know, we'd like to take another look at this report card. We'd like to look at what are the measures we actually want to have on this report card. So that could mean that some of the stuff may change. They want to bring the private schools that get public money. Those are the voucher schools. They want to keep those in it. In the last session, lawmakers did agree to bring voucher schools into the system, but they didn't hammer out any of the details about how that would actually happen. So it could be that they look at, you know, what are the tests we're actually using that bring the data into this report card system. So it's going to be a bit of a bumpy ride because it's really complex and it's going to affect a lot of different schools in the state.
And the priorities you just laid out from the schools on the one hand, and similar, I think, to the DPI, the Department of Public Instruction, and then legislators on the other hand are not really overlapping that much. Have we heard much from legislative leaders about any of the requests from the Department of Public Instruction or the School District Administrators Group?
Some of the lead Republicans have said that in theory they would like to be, they could get behind an idea that would, they like the idea of funding innovative pilot projects in schools that could look at how we deliver education differently, right? So we all know that education today looks about the same way it did in classrooms 100 years ago in terms of, you know, sort of a lead teacher and kids in seats and desks. So the administrators have said, hey, how about some extra money for grants that would allow districts to try out some of these new technologies and new ways of teaching, personalized learning, and you know, sort of these more progressive styles of teaching. Lawmakers have said, okay, well, you know, that's kind of a neat idea. There has been some talk of school funding reform on the side of Republicans as well, but as one more moderate Republican said to me, you know, it's really tough to mess with the school finance formula unless there's new money to give away, because in shaking everything out in a different way, there's going to be winners and there's going to be losers, and nobody really wants to touch that if they're going to end up reducing the flow of money to certain districts. So it could be that that is sort of in theory they may be in favor of that, but whether it actually gets done, I suspect it may be more of a conversation starter and not something that would actually get accomplished in the next two-year session or the next two-year budget.
Now, another stakeholder, of course, parents, and we're going to invite them and others to call in on this topic. Is there any, I don't know, I don't think there's a parents lobbying group, but is there really an organized voice for parents advocating for kids on these issues?
You know, that's a great question. There really hasn't been in the state. I mean, there are individual PTA groups for districts, and I believe there's a state figure for that as well. But most of the time, you see some of the parent lobbying groups come down to special interest areas. And I mean that by, for example, parents of students with special needs are often represented by several agencies in the state that really have the resources to advocate for them. You know, you see some parents who really like the idea of voucher schools and the expansion of voucher schools speak up, but those are more on an individual basis. I would say there hasn't been a big organized rise here of a sort of a main key parent group. They're mostly smaller and organized around special areas of interest.
Well, maybe our listeners can join on this as we talk with Erin Richards. She's education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We're hearing lots of plans for the future of Wisconsin education from school administrators, from the Department of Public Instruction, and from leaders of the upcoming legislature as they get ready to write a budget. And that's what we're talking about, these competing education priorities. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking about the differences between lawmakers and educators when it comes to education priorities in the state. And we want to hear from you on this. How do you think your school district is faring right now? What would be at the top of your priority list if you were a lawmaker or school administrator? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Erin Richards stays with us. She's education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. I'll go right to our callers. We've got Jean on the line in Ashland. Jean, hi.
Hi. I think I was told a long time ago that the U.S. Constitution does not provide completely for public education because there was always the danger of the public education being taken over by a regime like the Nazi regime a long time ago. And that the public schools would be taught things that the people didn't want to be taught. Anyway, so I believe that everyone should get a voucher, and it's nobody else's business where they go to school. They get the voucher to help them get their education, get textbooks, and some of the textbooks, maybe all the textbooks have some errors in them. But they have vouchers, and they can go where they want to go on those vouchers.
I gotcha, Jean. Thanks for the call. And Erin, I don't know if the legislature would move quite that far, but there, as you touched on earlier, there's talk of raising the amount of students who have access to voucher alternatives, or maybe even lifting the current cap on the number of students in voucher programs in Wisconsin.
There is. So there's three separate voucher programs right now. The longstanding program in Milwaukee, which has about 28,000 kids in it at the moment. A smaller program in Racine, and then the much smaller new statewide program that's been pushed forward by Scott Walker and other Republicans. And that program is capped at 1,000 students right now. There's a pretty good sense among most people that that cap will be significantly lifted or potentially taken off completely for the statewide program. But remember, how to fund that is another issue. If you let everybody go to a voucher immediately, it would make for a real headache with trying to figure out how to fund it. So that you may see a more measured a proposal for a more measured increase simply because of the funding concerns.
Thanks a lot for the call, Jean. We'll go now to Deb in Appleton. Deb, hi. Deb, are you there?
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air, Deb.
Hello. My question or comment had to do with the cost of the teacher effectiveness, the system that's put in place by the state. I'm wondering what the cost, you talked before about the cost of the training of the administrators to administer the program, but what about the cost in hours for the administrators to actually implement the program, for the teachers to implement the program, and what's that taking away from in the school day as far as the cost to our students themselves?
Deb, thanks for the call. Erin, I don't know if you have numbers or if anybody tracks numbers on this, but is there any sense that the time taken for these principal and teacher accountability programs we talked about earlier is cutting into education time?
Deb brings up a great point. That's something we often don't write about because it doesn't have an exact dollar figure tied to it in terms of time. But I do think there's a growing sense among people that, if you're teachers and administrators were doing everything they were doing before, and then you also switch to new statewide assessments and a new evaluation system, it's understandable that you would be spending a lot more of your time learning how to switch to a new system. And indeed, I think that you're hearing from parents saying, I don't think my kid is getting as much one-on-one attention as they used to. Or you hear teachers and principals saying, I have so many more burdens on my time and nothing has fallen off the table. I've simply adopted more things. The thing that may suffer is time with students. So I think that that's absolutely a concern. One issue is that we don't have a good way to calculate what that is worth in terms of time and money.
We're talking to education reporter Aaron Richards about differing school priorities from school administrators, from the legislature, from the Department of Public Instruction. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What do things look like in your district from your perspective as a parent, a student, a teacher, an administrator, or a taxpayer? What do you think needs to change? What's your wish list for education in the state and in your area? 800-642-1234. 1234 is the number to call. Back to our callers now. Ryan is on the line in Waukesha. Ryan, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. My comment and question is that the will to make the changes that have been suggested even at the onset of your program today to personalize education and focus, quite frankly, on the classroom, invest in teachers and their skill levels, really is a great deal of the, I think, solution. But throwing a lot of money at things and building the bureaucracy and looking at the huge structures to change schools and their impact, I think is the wrong approach. We need to focus on the classroom and the expertise that the teacher has.
Ryan, thanks for the call. So a lot of, it sounds like institutional inertia when he says the focus should be on being agile and being willing to try new things in the classroom, Aaron.
Yeah, and you've seen the administrators ask for that as well in terms of these, grants for funding innovative practices, trying to return some of the money and funding and energy to individual teachers and how to make them better. Of course, the statewide evaluation system is trying to do that in sort of a more systematic and sort of broader way. But I do think there is some desire for that, and yet it's tough to get that message across. I think a lot of teachers feel like they could be pushing some more interesting things to sort of build up their classrooms and improve teaching and learning, but oftentimes their work gets bogged down by the bureaucracy and other funding priorities.
Back to our callers now with Amy N. Sullivan. Amy, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. Well, I am just responding to the comment made by your guest that some people are or that people are thinking that maybe some of this ed effectiveness stuff is taking away from their students and our students in the classroom. And I would like to argue that, as for me and my colleagues, most of the time we've spent learning the ed effectiveness system and writing our SLOs and TPGs, all of that has been done on our time, not paid time, but time on weekends or after school. And I think it's taking more away from our families than it is our careers, And I'm not complaining about that because I'm a professional and I value my students and I think there's maybe some good in these initiatives. But I just think as a PR thing, I wish people would realize how much extra time teachers do put in.
Amy, thanks for the call. So Aaron, she's saying a lot of this accountability type stuff and training, these training things, are volunteer hours in effect for teachers?
I don't think I could say it any better than Amy. I think sometimes we really have to listen to teachers and hear how they're spending their time. That's been a big question. How do you expect people to do a lot of new things all at the same time? Wisconsin's education landscape has changed a lot just in the past 3 or 4 years with the varying amount of initiatives and different programs. And I do think it's a question to ask. How are teachers doing that? According to Amy, she's spending a lot of her personal time doing that. I don't know if that's the same across the board, but you certainly have heard in a variety of different ways that teachers are being expected to do a lot more with the same amount of resources or less than what they had before.
Amy, thanks for the call. To Carrie with us in Milwaukee now. Carrie, hi.
Hi. Thank you very much for answering questions today, Aaron.
Oh, thank you.
I have a question about which agencies review curriculum for school choice schools.
Which agencies review curriculum for school choice schools? Well, that doesn't happen because they're private schools, and so they're able to teach whatever curriculum they would like to teach. That's individually chosen. But I would add that public schools also, you know, within a local control state, public schools also, you know, get to choose the textbooks that they want to use, get to choose how they're going to teach students. Even if we have agreed upon standards for what you should know by the end of, you know, third grade, public schools do have the freedom to choose what they're going to do as well, but it does have to meet the state standards.
Thanks a lot for the call, Carrie. So a lot of opinions out there from various stakeholders, Aaron. How do you see, and we can't predict the future, but how do you see all this playing out as the schools have their requests for the legislature has its own priorities? What do you see in the first few months of the next session on education?
A lot of activity in Madison. I think it's going to be a really active session. Of course, there's going to be a lot of other issues that get attention as well. But man, I think education is really going to be a roller coaster of a ride here. And we already had a pretty active session the last time around on these. I do think it's good. It's always good on this show to hear from more teachers and parents too, because I think that's the one voice that we don't always hear from as much oftentimes because people have other jobs during the day. But I do think it's really good to keep that conversation going and to and hear what people have to say as this all gets hashed out in Madison in the next few months.
Aaron, thanks a lot for joining us as always.
Always a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
That's Aaron Richards. She's an education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Time for Wisconsin Life. Hunting has been an integral part of Wisconsin's history and culture, but participation in hunting has declined in recent years. The Learn to Hunt program from the DNR aims to mentor a new generation of hunters.
I'm Keith Warnke. I'm the Hunting and Shooting Sports Coordinator with Wisconsin DNR. This is the third iteration of our Learning to Hunt for Food course. The course is aimed at teaching young adults who have an interest in hunting how to hunt, and for their interest primarily comes from the fact that they'd like to locally source food.
Safe direction first. Safety is on, so that's black on this one.
The typical hunter is 50 years old in Wisconsin and is generally of Caucasian race and from a rural area and also generally male. Typically, parents take out the children and you learn to hunt from your father or your uncle or your grandfather. In this case, the people in this class don't have any connection like that to hunting. So what we're providing really is just the connection to hunting. And then, since hunting is such a deeply spiritual, sort of emotional connection to the land, I think that provides a lot of benefit for people as well.
There's two kinds of double barrels. One is an over-under, and one is a side-by-side. So they're really creative names, right? That's an over-under.
My name's Kelly Maynard. I moved to Wisconsin just over 6 years ago for grad school, and one of my first roommates was from the UP, and he had grown up hunting. And he had a chest freezer with meat in it, so that was where I got, you know, and he was very generous, so I tasted a lot of venison that year. And he was a big storyteller, so that was where I really got my first exposure to what, you know, deer camps were like and deer season and sitting out in the cold, just, you know, kind of through his stories. Even though I'm an adult and I'm female and I don't have this connection to it in my family, like, maybe it's something that I could learn to do.
We'll talk a little bit about field dressing this deer, We have situations where, you know, people have come to us in the past and said, you know, I don't know that I'm going to be able to shoot a deer if a deer walks by after this training. And that's okay. What this is about is to get people that exposure to hunting and being able to feel like they understand more about hunting and conservation. And if they want, participate in harvesting their own locally sourced meat. My daughter, when she was 12 years old, who was a hunter, is a hunter, had shot a couple of deer and ducks by that time, decided she was going to be a vegetarian. And I said, you know, I was trying to be the reasonable parent. I said, well, okay, let's talk about that decision. You really love to go hunting and you've killed a couple of deer. And she looked at me and she said, no, Dad, if we shoot it ourselves, that's okay. So what my daughter was really doing was making a step toward local, humanely sourced meats. And so she still hunts to this day, as does my other daughter. They come with me as often as we possibly can get out together.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org.
To talk about her experience in the Learn to Hunt program, we're joined by Leah Zeise. She's Outreach and Marketing Coordinator at the UW-Madison Office of Sustainability. Leah, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So what is your background with hunting before the Learn to Hunt program?
I grew up hunting with my mom, actually, so I did have some experience before I came to the class.
And so why go back to the class now? What brought you there?
Well, after going to college and being so far away from home, I wasn't able to hunt, and I was planning to go hunt this fall, so I thought I would refresh myself on hunting, and I really liked that the class was going to talk about ethics and deer biology, and the butchering experience as well was really enticing to me because I had never butchered a deer before.
So what? Take us through on a practical level. What did you actually do? Who was your, I gather there are mentors. How did this work?
Well, we got together as a class once a week for a couple of hours in the evening, and we talked about reading materials that we had been assigned to read the week before, and we discussed openly how we felt about, you know, the ethics in hunting or even the safety of hunting. And then there were also the field trips that we took to butcher the deer. And so we actually went out to a garage, and there was a deer carcass there for us to all work on. And we got some instruction as to how to go about it, but then they put the knives in our hands, and we were able to butcher a deer together.
What did you notice about the other people who were doing the class? Were they there for similar reasons as yourself?
We all had somewhat similar reasons, but I think a lot of people were trying to understand the hunting culture in Wisconsin, in part so that they could take part in it, but also so they could relate better to their families. And I thought that was a really interesting reason to take a hunting class.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about your family background. You mentioned hunting with your mother. What kind of lessons did you learn, maybe life lessons, growing up hunting with your mom?
I think it taught me to sustain myself and to really think about doing things myself and on my own if I can. And it definitely taught me the importance of learning the safety of equipment that I'm working with before trying it on my own.
And how did you feel after the class was over? Did you feel like you were a hunter?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I went into the class with hunting experience, so I did feel like a hunter before I got there. But after taking the class, I really felt like I had a fuller understanding of what hunting was about and different perspectives on hunting. Everybody's out in the field for different reasons. So that kind of helped me gain a better understanding and connection to, you know, being a hunter and what it's about for myself even.
We heard in that Wisconsin Life piece from one of the organizers of Learn to Hunt about the demographics involved here. Most males, or most hunters in perception reality, male, older, over 50, mostly white. So talking to people who aren't part of that demographic, how would you encourage them to explore hunting as part of their lives?
I would say that everyone should start where they're comfortable. The Learn to Hunt for Food class is a great way to start because It puts you into a classroom with your peers, and you're all learning together at the same pace. And then you have the opportunity to go out on a hunt with your peers and with mentors who will show you the ropes. So if it's the equipment that's the issue, they'll outfit you. If it's knowing where to hunt, they'll take you there. If it's knowing how to hunt, you know, there's a mentor there to show you how to do it along the way. They have classes for other wild game as well. So if it's pheasants or turkeys or other game that is a little bit less intimidating than a white-tailed deer, start where you feel comfortable. Start with fishing if you're not ready to hunt. That's what I would say.
Now, you said you had a fuller understanding about why hunt and how people, the culture worked in Wisconsin, and also a different understanding about the perspectives. What changed about how you viewed hunting after the class?
I think that I feel a little bit less like I'm alone out there in the field because I hunt with the perspective that I'm becoming closer to the land, and I'm participating in a cultural experience through my Native American heritage out in the field. And so to know that there are other people out there who are having that same experience or connecting to the land in that same way is really reassuring to me.
So are you out hunting this gun deer season in Wisconsin?
Yes, I am.
Any luck so far?
No luck so far. I've heard a lot of shots. I saw one giant buck who was just booking it far out of range, so didn't take a shot at him. But hopefully later in the season, things kind of calm down a little bit more. I'll get some luck.
Now, you said that a lot of people were in this class because they wanted to connect more to the culture and to their families. Do you feel that way? Do you feel more connected to your family heritage?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I feel kind of proud that I have butchering techniques now, that I can, when we're cutting up the deer together, I can make a little butterfly fillet now. So I definitely feel more connected in that way.
And are you going to explore the other hunting seasons you mentioned? You mentioned that Learn to Hunt doesn't just do deer, but other types of game, too. Do you see yourself branching out in the other seasons throughout the year?
Yeah, and I already had an opportunity to do that. I was invited to go hunting by Keith, the instructor, to go pheasant hunting. And so I went out and got my small game license and my pheasant stamp. I've never hunted for anything but white-tailed deer in the past. And he took me out hunting with his dogs, who could not have been more excited. And it was really a great experience. And I will definitely continue pheasant hunting. And I'm thinking about turkey hunting now. I'm thinking about bow hunting. So definitely new avenues of hunting have opened up to me through this class.
What is your favorite part of the whole hunting experience?
I would say the quiet of being outside and just that anticipation and that waiting just adds to the experience so much. And then later, definitely cooking the food and sharing it. That is my secondary. And then you get to share the story, right, when you're over dinner. So I think I know you asked for one, but those are my favorite parts of the experience.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Leah.
Thank you very much. Have a great night.
You too. That was Leah Zeise, Outreach and Marketing Coordinator at the UW-Madison Office of Sustainability.